Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Thanks for listening today, everybody. And with Citizens United relevant to the IRS Tea Party scandal and some major decisions on the way anytime now, let's get a take on the Roberts-era Supreme Court with Marcia Coyle. If you watch the PBS NewsHour, you know her as a regular Supreme Court watcher. She's the chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal and has been watching the court for 25 years. She's got a new book out called The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Hi, Marcia. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to start with the IRS scandal
okay.
and the news now that they targeted conservative groups applying for 501c4 tax-exempt status for further scrutiny. Do you think the Citizens United ruling influenced the way these groups were formed and how they function and therefore set up the way that maybe they needed to be scrutinized?
Well, I think it did, Brian, and not just Tea Party organizations. But let me first say this about Citizens United. You had eight justices who did endorse the disclosure rules that the Federal Elections Commission has.
Only Justice Thomas dissented.
Exactly. And he dissented on First Amendment grounds and has had that position for a long time. But once the limits were off corporate and union independent spending and campaigns, it was sort of logical that the next step would be to try to avoid saying who was funding campaigns. And that's when we saw the birth and the growth of these new tax status organizations.
So 501c4 has existed before the Citizens
Yes.
United ruling. Citizens United did not make it legal for 501c4s, which have tax-exempt status as social welfare groups, to suddenly be allowed to make political campaign-related expenditures. But did the Citizens United ruling make the 501c4 designation murkier in a way that made the IRS have to scratch their heads in different ways?
I think it did. During the presidential election campaign, we had a number of campaign finance reform groups complaining that the 501(c) organizations were not sticking to what they were supposed to be doing. They were not promoting social welfare concerns or issues, that they were crossing over into the political realm. So I think, yes, definitely, that Citizens United really sort of – it not only was a very practical decision in terms of its impact in lifting the limits, but it also created something of an atmosphere that encouraged this happening.
So the IRS, knowing that after Citizens United there might be politically motivated groups applying to be 501c4s – I guess they set out to scrutinize these applications to make sure they, in fact, were social welfare groups, which is what the mandate is.
That's right.
Not primarily campaign finance groups.
I don't really know what the IRS was thinking at the time, but I do know there were complaints from the campaign finance reform groups, and that may well have triggered the IRS's greater interest in these organizations.
Before we move on, just one
Sure.
other thing on this. Do you think the Roberts Court was blind to the predictable outcome of Citizens United, that there would be a flood of new applications to become political action groups in 501c4s?
I think they were a little naive, and I think the loss of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the only justice who had actually run for office, served in a political position when she was in Arizona, really makes a difference because she was able to bring to the table in the court some practical experience. She, by the way, had over her career on the court moved in favor of limits, federal limits on campaign expenditures and spending.
My guest is Marcia Coyle, her new book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. And in your book, you write about four landmark cases
That's
of the
right.
Roberts Court. We just talked about Citizens United,
yes.
obviously one of them. The Affordable Care Act ruling
right.
is another one having to do with race and education. And you also write about the Heller gun case, which you say started with two lawyers deciding over drinks to manufacture a Second Amendment case. And in fact, all four landmark Roberts Court decisions, you say, had at their inception very smart and talented conservative or libertarian lawyers who handpicked the most sympathetic clients for their lawsuits. What happened in Heller?
Well, as you recall, this was the big Second Amendment challenge. What does the Second Amendment guarantee? Does it guarantee an individual right to have a gun, or is it a right tied to the militia? And it really is fascinating how some of the lawyers put some of these cases together. The two lawyers who constructed the Heller case felt the time was right. The Ashcroft, Attorney General John Ashcroft at the time had come out with a memo saying that he believed the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual right. There was a case out of Texas that leaned that way. And so they thought, you know, we've got all the ingredients here for a challenge. And they put it together and brought it through the lower courts up to the Supreme Court, which settled the big debate.
And remind us, for people, since the gun issue has been so in the news recently,
yes,
who maybe didn't follow the Heller ruling closely, but kind of scratch their heads now at the individual right to bear arms as affirmed in that case and say, wait, how did they dismiss the in order to maintain a
militia?
Well-trained militia? How did they dismiss that clause again?
This was a fascinating debate on the court, and it was really a debate about history. What were the framers of the Constitution thinking at the time the Second Amendment was drafted? And there were two very different views of what was happening at the time of the Second Amendment. Justice Scalia led the view that the original meaning of the Second Amendment was an individual right, and he traced that all the way back to English history. Justice Stevens focused mainly on the time around the Second Amendment, and he said, no, this really didn't have anything to do with individuals carrying guns. It really was about protecting the people from a government taking away their guns for a militia. So, it was a dramatic break, a dramatic divide on the court, but Justice Scalia's view won.
So, and listeners, we have a few minutes for phone calls about the Roberts Court, the four landmark cases, or overall what the Roberts Court is doing to or for or with the United States Constitution, depending on your point of view. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC are on air line to talk to Marcia Coyle, author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Right now, obviously, there's a receptive conservative majority on the court, slim though it may be. How are lawyers who champion causes on the right shaping their approach to the high court these last 7 years? We've started to talk about how, you know, clever lawyers come up with these cases rather than necessarily organically through plaintiffs, individuals who feel that they've been wronged.
Right.
These are kind of political thrusts. And is it the kind of thing that always happened, depending on the majority of the court? Maybe, you know, liberal groups did the same exact thing during the Warren Court era. Or is this recent period unique in the way this is playing out?
Well, I don't think it's unique in general because, as you just said, it's very true that this happened during the Warren Court, during the Civil Rights era. And sort of ironically, some of the lawyers that I talk to in my book do point to Thurgood Marshall as the one they look to in how he crafted his lawsuits in order to tackle segregation. And they have followed that model. I think what might be a little different right now is that we're seeing more of it in a very concentrated period. You know, the Roberts Court is going to be 8 years old in September. That marks when Chief Justice John Roberts took the bench. It's still a very young court. And to see this young court stepping into some of these really hot-button issues in such a short period of time is a little unusual. And, Brian, also the cases I picked, they have shelf life. We're probably going to see another gun case, if not next term, maybe the following term. Healthcare litigation is moving again. We have race back on the docket right now. And next term, we have another big campaign finance case that was brought by the same lawyer who brought Citizens United to the court.
Huh. And on this idea of not a plaintiff who felt personally wrong necessarily, but something concocted by lawyers. Are we seeing that also in the Fisher versus University of Texas case, which will be decided any week now? Abigail Fisher, who was an actual student who didn't get into the University of Texas, though was not the driving force there,
right,
from what I've read in this affirmative action case. It was Edward Blum, the head of a conservative anti-affirmative action organization called the Project on Fair Representation.
That's absolutely true. Now, I wouldn't say that these plaintiffs, these clients that the lawyers find, don't feel wronged. They do. But what the lawyers are looking for are really articulate people with good claims. Ed Blum, in the Fisher case, you know, his whole strategy is to find the client, and then he finds the lawyer because he's not a lawyer, and then bring the lawsuit. He's also behind the big voting rights case we have this term that the court will probably decide next month.
Trying to say that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 isn't necessary anymore.
It's outdated, right.
In certain respects.
Yes.
For requiring certain southern states and other jurisdictions to pre-clear their voting law changes.
Absolutely.
So he's an activist having incredible sway, not just in the political sector, meaning Congress, but in the legal sector, having an influence on which questions the Supreme Court even chooses to reinterpret the Constitution on.
That's true. And I think a lot of this comes from frustration with Congress or the legislature not doing what some of these organizations want, so they turn to the courts.
How about the Affordable Care Act? Justice Kennedy sided with the more conservative justices, and
yes,
Roberts sided with the more liberal justices. And, of course, he's gotten so much blowback from the right for that. And you write that the decision, quote, avoided an ideological split that would have made the court vulnerable to charges of partisan politics.
I think so, yes.
Do you think that's what Roberts was consciously trying to avoid?
I don't know what Roberts thinks, and we probably won't know until maybe 50 years after he leaves the court. But I think as Chief Justice, there is a bigger concern, maybe a greater concern than the other justices have, and that's for the credibility of the institution. I do believe, I take him at his word, that he found that the tax issue saved the mandate to buy health insurance, that this was constitutional under the taxing power. And he laid out his arguments. But you sort of have to believe in your gut that there also was a concern about the court becoming an election year issue. And perhaps, you know, he thought, well, okay, I can reasonably find the mandate constitutional this way, and I'm going to do it. At the same time, though, it's working out that the court doesn't become an issue.
He's always been very concerned about the credibility of the court. I was reading into the Citizens United decision last night in preparation for the conversation that we had and that we had with our previous guest on the relationship between that and the IRS scandal. And even in that, he expressed a concern for the credibility of the court, right?
He did, because it had only been a few years earlier that he had written an opinion that actually upheld the decisions that he was overturning this time. And that's a big step. That delivers a jolt. And he had said during his confirmation hearings that he stood by old decisions so as not to deliver jolts to the legal system or to the public. His concurring opinion in Citizens United is all about why he made the decision to overturn those earlier cases. And I think he felt he had to do that so that people would read it and decide for themselves whether he was making an honest decision here.
So I know you've written a book, hundreds of pages of long with complex analysis.
I hope not too complex.
But appropriately complex analysis of these four major decisions, very readable.
Good.
Is there a bottom line conclusion that you can say in a radio interview, you know, that, okay, this is the impact of the Roberts Court on the Constitution?
I think, Yes, I think in this way, we right now have a very confident conservative majority. Sometimes, you know, it's a little shaky because of Justice Kennedy, but in certain areas of the law, they're very confident, at times very bold, and at times willing to act in ways that aren't considered conservative for a court. So, yes, but again, I emphasize—
You don't mean politically conservative, that aren't considered restrained?
That's what I mean, exactly, yes. Try to stay away from the politics here. But what I'm hoping people will do is come away from the book with a more nuanced view of the court. These are tough issues, and I believe the justices really do try to work through them and come out with what they think is the right direction. But you can't overlook the fact, you can't be naive about the fact that you do have five Republican-appointed justices, and you have four Democratic appointed justices, and their ideologies are going to be somewhat sympathetic to the appointing president's ideology.
So we have 2 minutes left before you go, because I can't resist.
Okay.
What do you think about Sandra Day O'Connor expressing doubts recently about having taken the Bush v. Gore case at all in 2000? You were covering this. This is not
yes,
in your
I
book,
was.
But you were covering the court then.
Yes. Yes,
have you ever, in your years covering the court, 25 years, had a justice go back on an iconic decision or publicly expressed doubt?
Not in my covering the court, and not on a decision that big. Certainly, Justice Lewis Powell had regrets after he left the court for Bowers versus Hardwick, which was one of the seminal gay rights cases. But
where they had upheld at that time
Georgia's anti-sodomy law, right? And that was overturned then in the Lawrence case out of Texas. So he did regret that. And there are justices who have regretted their views of the death penalty. They changed those. But Justice O'Connor, I will say this. She didn't say that she thought the decision was wrong. She only said that maybe they shouldn't have taken it.
Which is pretty huge.
Yes,
if they hadn't
is.
Taken it, that would have had the effect as if they had ruled on Gore's side, because the count would have gone on in Florida in the way Florida was doing it.
A number of them believe that Bush would have won anyway.
Right, which is a whole other question.
Yes, it is.
How those recounts would have come out.
Exactly.
And so you mentioned Lawrence. The last question I can't resist but to ask you is about these gay marriage cases.
Yes.
Two before the court right now that we might hear about any day before the end of June. Eight, California ban on gay marriage as voted by the public, and then the Defense of Marriage Act challenge to federal law. Do you have a prediction?
Oh, I hate to predict, but if you promise not to come back and say, oh, Coyle was wrong, I'll say this. One, I don't think the court is ready to announce a national right to marriage for gay couples. I do think they may get rid of Prop 8 in a way that doesn't address the main question, whether states can define marriages between a man and a woman. They may find a technical reason. I think the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which does define marriage that way, is in serious trouble, and that may fall.
On the grounds that?
It discriminates against legally married same-sex couples.
Who are legally married in states that have legal gay marriage.
Exactly.
All right. We will see. Well, we won't hold you to it, no, like a you know, one of those sports commentators who predicts in April who's going to win the World Series.
Right, right.
Nobody ever goes back to those guys. You are wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. Knowing what she's talking about, Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal, and you see her talking about the Supreme Court regularly on PBS. Her new book is The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.